You're listening to the weekly Portland podcast. For a complete list of episodes, visit pdxpod.com or find us on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Remember to like, share, and subscribe.
The Punchesque Row is the new novel by Tal M. Klein and is soon set to be adapted into a major motion picture by Lionsgate Films. The sci-fi techno-thriller is set in a future in which genetically engineered mosquitoes have curbed global warming and human teleportation is now possible. In fact, it's the safest form of commercial transportation. My name is Gregory Day, and you're listening to the Weekly Portland Podcast, but you probably already knew that. Tal is currently on a book tour and caught up with us at the Nines Hotel before his stop at Powell's Bookstore. I'm meeting with so many wonderful authors, it's great. Philip Margolin will soon be on talking about his legal thrillers. That's going to be a ton of fun, which is also the same word I'd use to characterize the Punchesque Row. Tal has a great sense of humor. Let's meet the author.
Lionsgate deal happened before the book came out. It was crazy. It's all the credit goes to this guy, Howie Sanders at United Tel Agency, and he's a character. I mean, everybody needs to meet Howie Sanders. He's my agent at United Tel Agency, and he's this guy is the most amazing person I've ever met in my life. He's just such a character that you almost believe him to just be a prototype. You know, just part of my deal with Inkshares is representation through UTA.
Yes, I read this.
And it doesn't guarantee you that they're going to do anything with it, but it gets you representation,
right?
And so Howie read the book.
Was this luck, blind luck?
That he read the book?
No. Or? Yes, that it fell in his lap.
Yeah. I mean, I attribute 100% of my success to luck.
Really?
The chances of any of this happening are so slim that whenever anybody asks me how I did it, I have to say I got lucky. Like,
they really are, yes.
You know, because I don't think this is repeatable.
It's an incredible story.
I mean, I think people are going to be successful through Inkshares. There's already a lot of, there's the Astronaut Instruction Manual, there's Dracula versus Hitler. So I think there's going to be a lot of people who are successful through Inkshares. But for me, you know, a 40-year-old guy from a suburb of Michigan, writing his first novel,
right.
And getting it optioned and having, you know, all this stuff is so surreal that the likelihood of this particular outcome is probably, you know, equal to winning the Powerball. And people win the Powerball, as we know. So it's, you know, it happens. So to me, this is my Powerball. I mean, I'm so glad it's happened and it's opened a lot of doors for me and my family, you know, frankly. And I think that... But I look in the mirror and I'm like, I'm lucky.
I love that humility you have.
It's just truth. I don't know if it's humility. it's just truth, honestly. Like I would like to say that this is all like part of a grand design. I did make a lot of decisions that, you know, people said were crazy. You know, I issued a traditional publishing deal, which I was offered to go with Inkshares,
yes,
and my agent at the time fired me for it. You said, you're crazy. Yeah. Look, at the end of the day, we only get to carve our own path. And, you know, it's like what my mom always said, you make your own bed. As I get on in years, I realize that there are pivotal decisions in life. There are decisions that you make that it's very important to recognize when you are making a decision that will have fundamental resonant impact on you for the rest of your life. It has to do with careers, love, you know, there are decisions that are arbitrary. There's decisions that are non-arbitrary, and then there's decisions that you think are arbitrary or non-arbitrary that turn out to be the opposite. And this was just one. I mean, I chose Inkshares.
Because on the surface, it doesn't make sense for a first-time writer to turn down a publishing deal.
Right.
On the surface.
Right. I didn't need
like
the money.
That marketing scheme.
I didn't
like
I
that,
didn't. Number one
ideas.
Is I didn't need the money.
Right, you didn't need the money.
The nice thing about being older and having an established career is you're not the starving artist. The problem with being a starving artist, and I've been one, you know, I ran a music label for like 20 years. You know, I've been a starving artist, and I've accepted deals that I shouldn't have as a musician, and that's a lesson learned. Yeah. So, I said if I ever get the opportunity to do something again, like, I'm not just going to jump at the first deal that comes at me. I'm gonna think about what's the best possible outcome for this thing, because being offered a publishing deal by a major publisher tells me one thing, which is there's something.
You're onto something. Yes, absolutely. You know, you have written a unique book.
Thank you.
And you've touched on this in other interviews. It's not a bleak vision of the future.
No.
Is what you've written. And that, I think, is very unique.
It's not bleak. It's not dystopian. It's not utopian either. Because
that's true. It's based in reality.
As I said...
And Culture Club tunes.
And Culture Club tunes. I was on a local show here. I was at AM Northwest this morning. And
you
I
was were,
I was
yes.
talking about that. And I said, I wanted to create a future that was a pragmatic,
realistic,
follow a pragmatic path towards the future. So present, not the future present, because right now the present is kind of screwed. But like,
right.
You know, the present as it was when I was writing the book. And I like the fact that, you know, in the future people go back to smoking because it's curable. Like, we go back to our old habits, even though they're still unhealthy for us.
Right.
But just because, you know, we can cure lung cancer, so whatever, it's a trip to the doctor, but we can smoke. So we go back to our vices.
You know what I think also really worked in your favor is you have a marketing background. You mentioned, as far as promoting this book, one of the reasons why you turned down this publishing deal was that you felt like the people who are going to read it are online. They're on Reddit. They're on Nerdist, Geek & Sundry. You really have that sort of background.
Right.
Like, you want to channel that. And
well,
you just,
these are my people.
Yeah. Those
you know,
are
it's
people.
Like, who am I writing this book for? You know,
who are you writing it for?
The person who goes to Nerdist.com, the person who goes to GeekAndSundry.com, that is my target audience.
Yes.
Like, I could not frame them in a better picture. It's like, so if I already have such a visceral understanding of my audience, like, and going to market with that,
straight to them.
Yeah.
You know, Daniel Wilson is actually a local author.
He
lives here in Portland. So what's your relationship with him?
We share a publicist.
Share a publicist.
Yeah, we share Elena Stokes from Wunderkind. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Maybe that's why they contacted me. I just spoke with Daniel just a few weeks
ago. Phenomenal guy. Yeah.
Yeah. The Clockwork Dynasty. It's also a great audio book.
Yeah.
Spanning ages of time, creating
a
universe.
I love the conceit of the book. It's brilliant. I love the idea that society had already evolved to this wonderful state, created these wonderful robots, then devolved.
Yeah.
And these robots are stuck.
Yeah.
Waiting for us to evolve again.
It's epic tales.
It's a really, I love that. I love Robo Apocalypse. I mean, he's a great writer. Yeah.
Philip Margolin, also a local writer. Yeah. He's a big fan of that book. One thing I do want to touch on, comms.
Yes.
Can you explain to the listeners, in
sure.
your book, what is a comm? What are comms?
The easiest way to think about it is people like the word implants, but I call them synthetic organs. Because in the future, most of the technology is not going to look like bits of metal, and you know, it'll look like a piece of skin, like an organ. And you know, the reality is, if we look at the direction things are going, it makes more sense for our phone to be inside of us, to be directly tied to our ocular nerves, to our and also for augmented reality to just exist directly to our, you know, optic nerves. Just why do we need these things to be external devices?
Yeah,
you know, it's a terrible inconvenience. Or in my case, like today, like when I forgot my phone in my hotel and had to turn my Uber around to go back to go get it.
Right.
You know, you'll never forget your wallet again. You'll never forget your phone again. You'll never forget your Fitbit again. And you know, all these things that we rely on today that give us telemetry about ourselves and allow us to meaningfully interact with the world around us are going to be built into us. The downside is complete and utter loss of privacy, and this dependence on this technology for identity. And that's kind of, you know, the central conceit of my book is not so much, this is where I think a lot of people get it wrong. It's not about the dangers of teleportation. It's actually about the dangers of identity that's tethered to technology. Because if society only perceives us by who our phone says we are,
this and somebody's touched on in the book,
yeah,
and it's very profound.
Well, I think that's the central conceit. It's like, who are we?
Yeah, who are you?
And it's not about teleportation as duplication. It's not about it. That to me is a MacGuffin. It's mainly a literary device intended to trigger the discussion.
And there's religious overtones that come into play too.
That's right. Like, and who are we? And you know,
who are you? What are we?
And the conclusion, you know, I reach personally in the book, is we hang somewhere in the balance between who society tells us we are, and who those we love tell us we are. If Sylvia believes, you know, Joel 1 is Joel, then I truly believe that Joel 1 would believe he is himself, regardless of whether his comms worked or not. Yeah. Same thing with Joel 2.
I really felt for Joel 2. He's an intriguing character.
Yeah. I mean, he's amazing. And
I was thinking about Joel 2 after finishing this book. He is, for me, he's the most compelling character.
I think so, too. What's funny about both of them, this is not spoilers, so I'm trying to, in my head, I'm measuring what I can and can't say. So neither Joel is the original Joel. If you believe teleportation is a process of destruction and recreation, neither of them is the original Joel. So
that's touched on, too.
Right. So neither of them get that claim. So if we throw that claim out the window, then the next question we ask is, you know, who does society say Joel is? In which case, it's Joel 2. If then you subscribe to my third thesis, which is regardless of what society says, if Joel defines himself through those who love him, and if he feels that those who love him have betrayed him,
right,
then can he trust that data source?
Yeah.
And that's where he breaks down. I think really his existentialism really comes from the fact that for a person who up until that point was in a relationship that was dwindling, waking, you know, having the dual epiphanies, one of how important that relationship is to self-identity, and then almost immediately afterwards how empty he feels, you know, once he can't trust that.
And Joel 1 is wondering that too.
That's right.
And so is Sylvia. I think when you read a book, put it down, you think about this book, you've got so many questions. I think that's a sign of that this is a great book.
Well, hopefully that's what it achieves. I mean, like I said, it's not for everybody, and I recognize that.
I felt like this was a ride, this book.
I owe a lot of that to my development editor, Matt Harry, who helped me really craft this, you know, to be more cinematic.
The ending is totally cinematic. The final third of this book. The ambulance on, it is a wild ride to the end of this book.
It turns into a kind of a techno thriller at the end, yeah, for sure. It's fun because, it's kind of like three different acts kind of take on, direct personalities, you know?
But after the climax, too, you've got some interesting introspection going on. And even the comment about the mosquitoes, the echoes of what it really wants to do.
Right.
It wants to bite you and drink your blood.
Yeah.
That was a very nice touch. I felt like the end of the book was very satisfying, too, after the climax.
Yeah. It was, you know, it's tough to decide what to do
with the characters afterwards.
Yeah.
Yes, because they have to live on with a memory of what happened.
Right. It was very interesting. It was an interesting problem. Once the Lionsgate deal happened, that's when I put the cliffhanger in. Like, originally there was actually the cliffhanger is a consequence of the Lionsgate deal, so you can blame them for that. I mean, I'm very happy it's in there, but the book did end at that point, and then I added the cliffhanger because now it's kind of cool because there's a ton of content. Like, one of the principal character who is underserved in this book is the antagonist, William Taravelle,
right?
Because he actually has an incredibly rich backstory which if you knew it, you would sympathize with a lot more.
Right, I could see that being explored.
He is a bad guy, maybe he's crazy, but there's definitely a reason for it, and it's a very good reason. And there's a lot of stuff going on with Taravelle that we don't know about.
I know you don't want to give away too much.
Well, so. I also don't. I want to make sure. I need to see how the movie. adaptation comes out, because if they make him just this certain, like, if he becomes like super cartoony in the movie, I don't know that he's worth redeeming, you know, but we'll see.
What's your take on Portland? What do you think of Portland?
This is my umpteenth time. I used to work for a company that did business with Intel, and I lived in the Bay Area, so I used to be here all the time.
Really?
I love Portland. Portland is like a chillier Austin to me.
Austin, yes. I've heard comparisons to Austin.
You know, just really, it's fun. I was walking down the streets. I went to the different Powell stores, like, signing inventory. So I had to sign books at, like, four different stores. So I'm kind of seeing, like, all these different sides of Portland, you know, in a very short, brief period of time. And I just said, you know, it's weird, and I love it. And that's what it is. I mean, Portland is wonderfully weird. And it's just, like, it's got... It doesn't have a single personality. Well, the initial draft, I just wanted to get it done. I mean, the one thing I knew is if I ever stopped and started editing, that I've started books before, and whenever I started editing midway through writing, that was the death sentence of the book. So I made a very conscious decision once I was done doing the research, because it was 3 years of research and then 2 years of writing. Once I was done doing the research and I set pen to paper, I would not let myself go back. No backsies. And that's why, if you ever read the first draft of this book, and I hope you never do, it's a complete mishmash, but at least it's done. There's a period at the end, and it's the end. And so that gave me the launch pad, and I felt very strongly that there was a good story there and I needed editorial help. But I also opened it strong. So I knew that the first three chapters were very coherent. We ended up changing those around too, but the original book opened with a chapter of the Big Mac of Theseus. So it was the opening chapter, which is a lot of info dumping.
Yeah, you know. What is a Big Mac?
Yeah.
Yeah, this was quite a long passage. What is a Big Mac?
What is a Big Mac?
Now, you just broke some news to me.
Yeah. So Dave Hoberman and Todd Lieberman, who are the producers of the live-action Beauty and the Beast movie, who also worked with James Bobin on the Muppets movie, are now attached to produce.
Which I loved. I loved the Muppets movie.
It's amazing, right?
One of the best.
It's amazing. And you know what else James Bobin did is Flight of the Conchords.
Also fantastic.
I love it. You said you mentioned you listened to the Geek Girl podcast, and so like one of my favorite things about Flight of the Conchords is actually there's two favorite things. One is it would have been very easy for that show to be seen as a ripoff of Tenacious D.
Yes.
Because both on HBO, totally. Both failing bands, whatever. And the other part is that the synopsis for that show sounds really depressing, which is like two deadbeats from New Zealand don't make it in New York. Don't really try either. To take something that sounds, that could have just been called derivative, and right. Something that could have been just sorely depressing, and turned it into this beautiful show full of wonder and delight, you know, it takes a very special skill. You struggle when writing struggle with writing a hard science fiction book is sometimes reality will out innovate you because you're not a scientist. And so in my case, you know, I had all these mosquitoes lined up, and all of a sudden they discovered that there's methane eating bacteria out there. And I was like, that changes everything. I could just cover everything in methane eating bacteria, and the beta readers like revolted. I had like all my beta readers were like, if you get rid of the mosquitoes, we're going to stop reading your book.
That's right. I read in the acknowledgments of this book, you had a lot of beta readers.
Yeah.
And were they tough?
You have to be very selective when choosing beta readers, not so much because of keeping the book secret or whatever. But these are people that really make, their feedback makes significant fundamental changes to the way the book is written. And so it has to be people that you trust. My beta readers were a really good sample set of who I thought was the audience of the book. And by the way, now that the book is out, I realized that was terribly mistaken. Not in that they did a bad job, but what I'm seeing from the reception to the book is actually I vastly underserved the female community in my selection of beta readers. That is, I think over 60%, I think almost 70% of the people who have posted reviews of this book or have shown that they own the book on Goodreads are female. There's a chapter called Magic Mirror Gate, and that references, if you ever saw The NeverEnding Story.
Long time ago.
I remember there's this part where he has to look through the mirror and sees his real self, and it's... Yeah. And he said, you need the magic mirror gate. He's like, you need to confront all the things that you don't like about yourself. That's the only way that you can convincingly write, from a person's perspective, the only way you can effectively convey the character growth of both Joels is that they have to recognize things about each other that they don't like about themselves.
It was so real. I mean, I could visualize this conversation, staring at yourself.
Right. And it was really tough to figure out when the two Joels should meet and how they should behave. And
I'll bet.
The way it was presented in the book, I don't want to give any spoilers, but the way it was presented in the book, the way we landed on it, is there had to be a shift. What I mean by that is that there had to be a moment where Joel was preparing to do one thing and then be shocked into an empathetic moment. The shock had to be visceral because, you know, and it was really tough to write that part, especially in a book that's largely lighthearted. You know what I mean? But there had to be these moments that were poignant. And I'm very comforted to hear that you thought that. But you never know when you write. I mean, especially me. Like, I'm a first time author, so like every scene that every scene that you see in the book that has existential qualities, I probably did 20 to 30 versions of. Like, because it took, you know, I did not know how to get to that place.
It was written with such honesty. Right afterwards, we go back to the ambulance. I mean, I don't want to give away too much about this story.
It's tough, right?
There's a great moment after Joel, you know, connects with himself and they connect with an ambulance. The ambulance has a personality its own.
It's my favorite character in the book.
The funniest character in the book. Yeah. Where'd you get the inspiration for this wise-ass ambulance?
So my daughter, I have Siri, I have Alexa and Cortana. So like at home, my daughters speak to Alexa all the time.
Right.
Like, and they make fun of Alexa and they make her say silly things or tell them jokes and whatever. Right. And I remember one time they asked Alexa, tell me a joke. And Alexa like said, like some, I think it was like it was a knock knock joke, and it was like the interrupting cow joke. Do you know the interrupting cow joke? Let's go there. Right. Knock knock.
Who's there?
Interrupting cow.
Interrupting cow. Oh.
And so Alexa tricked my daughters. You know, it was an old joke, and you know, it's the first time they'd heard it. But like, but Alexa tricked my daughters, and I thought, wouldn't it be great if. If there was a character in the book that seemed like a very subservient sort of, you know, personal assistant type of application,
right.
that actually had a complete alternate agenda, and in its mind, it was just having fun with the moment because he recognized the absurdity of it.
One thing I found very interesting, there's no government in this universe.
Not as we know it. Yeah.
Anybody who
believes that lobbyists don't actually run the government. Although I guess what's interesting about the current American government is that I have no idea what's actually going on. I mean, this is the first time where for better or worse, I feel like there's this complete and utter anarchy in Washington. Which is an interesting perspective. I don't like this particular type of anarchy, but in many ways it does force us to think about, you know, watching corporate interests try to rein Trump in, watching like the coal lobby and like, and even now, like, you're watching, like, you know, the Dow is starting to get impacted. So like a lot of the high value people are starting to be like, come on, Trump, do the right thing. And he's like, no, he's just going to do whatever he's going to do. People no longer believe in the value of politicians, career politicians.
Right.
And
absolutely.
And at least in corporate officers, they have a fiduciary, they have a job.
Right. Yes.
And they may be evil. Like, I don't trust CEOs of companies, but at least you know that there's like some notion of, you know, some notion of values behind where they stand other than just to get reelected.
Right. Absolutely.
We're like, what's a politician's job? A politician's job today is to get reelected.
That's
like
true.
that is their raison d'etre. Like, you know, and that's a terrible thing to do. Like,
it's
that's a terrible.
It's awful.
Right. So at least if you're going to choose somebody who's power hungry, at least you want to have them be in a position where you understand the levers that control them.
That's a good way of putting it.
Yes.
One thing about this book I had to laugh at was that surge pricing is still a thing in the future.
Oh, I think surge pricing is very useful. Yeah. I mean, if you think about our economy and what doesn't work about it, is anytime right. you've got a static value to anything, it doesn't make any sense because and that's why I think Bitcoin is a really good example. Like, a Bitcoin is not worth anything at any given time, even if you try to sell your Bitcoin. The value of that transaction is not processed for some amount of time. So to think, you know, I think that having dynamic currency is a very healthy way to deal with market conditions, especially markets that move at the speed of light. Best way to get a hold of me is on Twitter. I'm Virtual Tal. The book, it's on Facebook. If you go to facebook.com/thepunchescrow, you will find it. I'm in the middle of a book tour that seems to be never ending. I think I don't know, when is this podcast going live?
Pretty soon.
Pretty
soon.
Weeks. So probably by the time this goes live, my next major event will be SpaCon in Arkansas, and I'm really looking forward to that.
When is that?
Sometime in late September. Okay. And I get to meet Barb from Stranger Things, so I'm very excited about that.
Wow, that's exciting.
She's actually my favorite character from Stranger Things, so I know that's strange, but it's Stranger Things, so I get to be strange.
And
so,
you're hitting independent bookstores, too.
I'm focused exclusively on independent bookstores.
Why is that?
I personally only buy books at independent bookstores, so I have my favorites. My favorite bookstore is in Ann Arbor. It's called Literati. They also make a phenomenal cup of coffee. I just think that bookstores... also, as ode to my past as a DJ. I really do believe in curation. I think that there's certainly we're going to have authors that we love, like people who love John Grisham. We're going to buy John Grisham books, and that's fine. They can buy that online. I don't care. But if you've got a notion of a story, or what independent bookstores allow you to do is establish a relationship with the person selling you a book, such that they can give you books you don't expect. The problem with things like Amazon and services like that, they're always going to give you something that tickles your immediate fancy. They're not going to give you anything out of left field. And
it's like old record stores, you know.
That's what I mean. When I used to DJ, my favorite store in San Francisco was called BPM. And there was this guy, Victor. And, you know, he would usually give me I would come in and he would select records for me and then give me my records. But then there'd always be like one or two records that were totally outside of my normal range that he was trying to turn me on to. And that's, I think, what independent bookstores do, you know, and I love that. I love that experience.
I think you've got a point. Another thing I didn't touch on earlier is the 80s music in this book. I just want to touch on this really quick because it's a big part of the character of Joel.
Yeah.
He loves 80s music. Is that you? Are you that character?
When I moved to the States... I moved to the States from Israel in 1987, so it was sort of like the tail end of New Wave. But when we moved, my cousin Jeremy was a huge New Wave guy, like Erasure.
Me too.
Yeah. So that was my experience, like coming to the U.S. His, you know, he had just adopted CDs, so he had like all these CDs, and like you know, and that was my experience. Like it was like, you know, Men Without Hats, Talking Heads, Culture Club. But and I actually got to DJ with Boy George, not, you know, like while he was, he might still be touring, but a while ago. But yeah, I was really upset because he never actually played any Culture Club songs, and I was looking forward to trying to revitalize my interest in them by watching him play them, but that never happened.
Right. No.
The other thing I would say, encourage your listeners to do, is go check out Inkshares. They're currently in the midst of doing a horror contest, so it's a really good opportunity for you to go pick some really cool new authors, voices in horror, and uplift them hopefully to where I am. Inkshares is not crowdfunding. And a lot of things, think it's crowdfunding. Crowdfunding is an input into the Inkshares algorithm, and what they're actually trying to do is figure out what the market wants. Meaning like the property market, so what's going to sell well in stores, what's going to convert well into movies, like how can we put together a story, because they believe in what they call the story economy. So when they run these contests, it's really based on the fact that their algorithms are telling them, like, right now people are hungry for horror. Yeah. You know, there hasn't been a really good horror book in a while. We're seeing a lot of resurgence, like It is coming back, and
It is huge now again.
And but there hasn't been, like, it's been a while since we had a really good horror story. And so I think they're tuning into that, and then they're partnering with a bunch of the horror. They've
really got their finger on the pulse, right? Inkshares, I think.
Yeah. And I think that's what it is. So as an author, you go in there, and not only do they help you, it's part of your job is to become noticed and get their attention. But once they notice you and you get in there, they help you hone your story into being something that is commercially viable. And that's really important.
Very important. Yeah. Wow, excellent. Well, Tal, this was a lot of fun.
I love it,
Greg. Enjoyed your book. Yes, it's a big world you've created, and hopefully this expands.
Thank you.
And, you know, Hollywood's calling, so that's always great. And,
it is fantastic.
Congratulations. This is just a great story. Your personal story is very inspiring. I think people take a lot from that.
I love being in my shoes right now.
Well, thanks.
Thanks,
again,
Greg.
Thank you so much.
All right, cheers.
And thank you for listening to the Weekly Portland Podcast at pdxpodcast.com. My name is Gregory Day. We will see you next week. Please join me. Why?